and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way that the federal government gets things done. And it's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
In the first episode, we talked about why the scale and complexity of modern government means we need agencies. Last time, we talked about how Congress has to give agencies the authority to fill in gaps that Congress can't or shouldn't specify. Today, we're talking about what stopped Congress from handing over all of its power. That's the non-delegation doctrine.
That's a good question. If delegation is so useful, why can't Congress just delegate everything?
So let's think about it this way. You're a film producer. What are some of the things that you need to do?
So I'm a producer.
You are. You're a producer.
Fantastic. So there's a ton we have to do if I'm producing a film. We have to secure financing. We have to hire the director and cast. We have to scout locations. We have to build the shooting schedule. We have to manage the budget, navigate union rules, handle legal contracts. I mean, the list goes on and on about how you produce a film.
It does. So you might go to the cinematographer and say, great, you're the cinematographer. I've hired you to do that. You're in charge of how it looks. You can do the lighting, the camera angles, the whole visual style. That's their area of expertise, is what you brought them in for. That's great.
So I'm delegating the cinematography, but what about everything else?
Right. So if instead you went to the cinematographer and said, great, now you're going to be in charge of securing financing, hiring the director, the cast, scouting locations, managing the budget, navigating the unions, doing all of that, suddenly you're no longer delegating. You're not really a producer anymore.
I'm basically just walking off the set and letting someone else do all the work for me.
Exactly. You've abdicated your role as a producer. That's what we don't want Congress doing.
Why not? Why don't we want Congress just abdicating its authority to the experts? Wouldn't it be better if the experts made all the decisions, including the laws?
So the problem with that is the Constitution.
That damned Constitution.
I know. Keeps getting in the way. You want to read what Article 1 says?
So under Article 1, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. That means Congress has the legislative power, like saying, you're the producer. You're responsible for the major decisions. You can delegate the cinematographer. You can delegate the costume design. You can delegate the sound mixing. You can't delegate being the producer itself, though.
Exactly. So Congress has the legislative power. They're the ones who have to make the major decisions. They can delegate part of this decision, but they can't delegate the entire thing. Agencies can execute decisions, and Congress can delegate the how you do something, but not the basic fundamental choice on what you're doing.
So if someone is making all of the fundamental choices, then they're really the producer, not me.
Exactly. Just like you're not the producer if you're not doing any of the work, we have the same concern with agencies. When we think of agencies, we think of them as being under the president as part of the executive branch. So the president can't be the legislature, and that means that neither can the agencies.
So is there a case that specifically lines out how this has played out between different powers of the government?
How could be that you would ask that?
So tell me about the Schechter poultry case.
All right. So we are in the middle of the Great Depression. Roosevelt is trying to get the national economy moving. Congress has passed the National Industrial Recovery Act. And let's read from a section of it.
So under the National Recovery Act, the president may approve a code of fair competition for the trade or industry if he finds that such associations and codes are not designed to promote monopolies or to eliminate or oppress small enterprises and will not operate to discriminate against them and will tend to effectuate the policy of this title.
So that's pretty big. Here's what the statute said. The president can pass codes that create codes of fair competition. And we know that they're going to be codes of fair competition if they tend to effectuate the policy of the title. It doesn't say what fair competition is. It doesn't say the goals. It doesn't say what to prioritize. So we've got a bunch of different industries writing their own rules about things.
It doesn't make any sense. That's basically handing over to the industry the capacity to make their own decisions.
So we still do that now to some extent. We just generally don't sanction it with the president's blessing. But back then, the industry would write the code, send it to the president. The president would say, yep, looks good, and sign it into law.
Why isn't that just abdicating your authority?
Well, it is. That's the reason we have the case. But let's talk about the live poultry code, because that was the one causing problems here.
Okay. So in the live poultry code, there was a prohibition against any method of slaughtering other than straight killing or killing on the basis of official grade. Purchasers may, however, make selection of a half coop, coop, or coops, but shall not have the right to make any selection of particular birds. What does that mean?
So they're trying to figure out how we can most effectively sell chickens, and they don't want people coming in and hand-picking chickens. It was supposed to be if you need just one or two, you reach in, you grab the first chicken you touch, and that's your chicken. If you're getting a large group, you could choose an entire large group, but not more specifically than that. And also said that if you were selling these chickens, you couldn't sell them if they were sick. It makes sense. There are probably good reasons not to be selling sick chickens. But the Schechter brothers, they were letting people choose their chickens, and they were selling sick chickens. They were cheaper, but they were still selling them. So this became the sick chicken case, and the court was not having any of this.
The Supreme Court, when they dealt with this, talked about the impact of the Recovery Act. And they said, Section 3 of the Recovery Act is without precedent. It supplies no standards for any trade or industry or activity. It does not undertake to prescribe rules of conduct to be applied, particular states, or fact determined by appropriate administrative rent procedure. Instead of prescribing rules of conduct, it authorizes the making of codes to prescribe them. In view of the scope of that broad declaration and the nature of the few restrictions that are imposed, the discretion of the president in approving or prescribing codes and thus enacting laws for the government of trade and industry throughout the country is virtually unfettered. We think the code-making authority thus conferred is an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power.
That's a lot of words. What they're saying here is there are absolutely no standards. You've handed over entire control of industries to the industry. The president will just sign off on it. We have no idea what Congress is actually trying to do here, and this won't fly. So this was one of two cases where the Supreme Court was upset about the delegation. This was actually the second of the two. The first one had happened earlier that year. That was Panama Refining.
So in Panama Refining, the president banned shipments of hot oil or oil produced in violation of state limits, but provided no standard for when or why to ban them. So no guidance at all for what the agency was to do.
Exactly. And we'll see next time that these aren't really that different. What was really different at the time was the way the court viewed this.
So how did the court view this?
So we are at the end of the Lochner era. What do you know about the Lochner era?
Oh, Lochner era, labor employment, or labor regulations, a limitation of baker's hours, state invocation, contracts clause. It's the whole panoply of constitutional law.
So this is where what the court is mostly protecting is what they view as people's right to contract or freedom to contract.
Which the court later rejects.
It does. But this is still part of that time. What they're really concerned about is allowing people to reach individual decisions with their employers about all of the specific requirements for their job. They don't want Congress or other legislative bodies like states coming in and saying you have to pay people a minimum wage.
So does this have to do with the difference between what a state can regulate versus what powers have been given to the state to function?
You'd potentially think it could. This is really just the Supreme Court absolutely hating every type of restriction people were trying to put in place to get out of the Great Depression.
That's fair. So then where do we go from here?
So Roosevelt wins in 1932. That's when you start seeing all of this action. Roosevelt wins in a landslide in 1936. And that's when he starts talking about court packing. So the idea is for every justice over 70 who won't retire, he gets to add another justice to the court. It looked like the decision had happened before he technically proposed it, but it certainly seemed to be in response to the court packing proposal. The Supreme Court changed its mind. So this is when they started viewing the job of government very differently. No longer is it the job of the court to police the government from intruding on any form of contract. It is now the job of the government to set safety limits in place.
So if it's not the job of the government to define what the safety limits are, but it's the job to set the general parameters, how do you effectively do that without a large bureaucratic system?
So that is what we'll be talking about next time.
Okay.
I'm going to start talking about the intelligible principle. At this point, though, we should look at the first case where the Supreme Court officially talked about the non-delegation doctrine. That's Yakus.
All right. Let's talk about Yakus.
So we're now in World War II. The government is trying to fight inflation. It passes the Emergency Price Control Act of 1942, giving the price administrator the authority to set maximum prices.
The administrator is authorized, after consultation with representative members of the industry, to promulgate regulations fixing prices of commodities, which in his judgment will be generally fair and equitable and will effectuate the purposes of this act when, in his judgment, their prices have risen or threatened to rise in extent or in a manner inconsistent with the purposes of this act. That is a really long way of saying that he has discretion to think about what prices should be.
It does. And the court has already upheld a number of other kind of social welfare programs, but this is the first time that they really explicitly start talking about this necessity of delegation.
So the Constitution, as a continuously operative charter of government, does not demand the impossible or the impracticable. It does not require that Congress and for itself or every fact upon which it desires to base legislative action, or that it make for itself detailed determinations which it has declared to be prerequisite to the application of the legislative policy to particular facts and circumstances impossible for Congress itself to properly investigate.
This is a completely different court. We're starting to see the results of all the action that was taken to get out of the Great Depression, and this is where we're in the major rise of the agencies.
So what Yakus seems to empower is Congress to say, you get the power to delegate to agencies that have the expertise, the capacity to actually make reasonable decisions around this particular area of operation.
Yes. And that's mattered. We see it again and again. So the last example we're going to be talking about today is the TSA.
You know how much I love to fly.
I do. You fly a lot, so this should really hit home. Okay, so these are the requirements that were present before September 11th and then were transferred to the TSA after September 11th.
The administrator shall prescribe regulations to protect passengers on an aircraft operating in intrastate air transport against an act of criminal violence or aircraft piracy. When prescribing a regulation under this subsection, the administrator shall consider whether a proposed regulation is consistent with protecting passengers, protecting the public interest in promoting air transportation and interstate air transport, and to the maximum extent practicable, require a uniform procedure for searching and detaining passengers and property to ensure their safety.
All right. So what do we have? We have that the administrator is supposed to make sure that we have some sort of thing in place to prevent criminal violence, and this will protect the public interest in passengers being transported safely and just the general airline industry overall.
So to say this in a more succinct way, that the TSA needs to balance the interest of safety against the convenience of air travel and what it takes for passengers to access that industry.
Yes. So if we're thinking about convenience, do you remember the good old days when you could bring as much liquid as you wanted in carry-ons?
Oh, yeah. I remember those days where you could pack a whole shampoo bottle in your carry-on and walk on the plane.
Yeah. So do you remember the year that changed?
It was probably 2001.
It wasn't. 2006.
Really?
Yeah. It was like significantly after 9/11. So in 2006, they foiled an attempt by bombers who were trying to use liquid to bomb a plane. Congress.
I remember this.
So in August 2006, they discovered this terrorist plot. And at that point, the U.S. and the U.K. immediately banned all liquids on planes.
I remember that's when we had to start putting things into little Ziploc baggies and 3x3x1.
That came the next month. There was a month where there was no liquid, which caused a lot of problems, as you can imagine. So they were trying to figure out how to balance people's need to take some sort of liquid on the plane with them with this desire for safety. So that was when they moved to the 3-1-1, the 3.4 ounces in 1-quart bags. So they're trying to address two risks here. Risk number one is that if we have really big bottles of stuff, we can have pre-mixed or highly concentrated liquid explosives that could blow up a plane. The other one is that if we have small amounts, like we don't want to have so many small amounts that we could then mix them into a big liquid that could then blow up the plane. So we're making it really difficult for people to try and mix chemicals to blow up the plane.
So it's basically a very pragmatic response to say, we want to limit the total amount of liquids because we think liquids are dangerous.
Yes. And this is the amount where it seemed like this was potentially going to be useful to people, but wouldn't be enough to blow a hole in the side of the plane, which was the concern.
Okay. So as we then think about this question about the power of the agency to make these decisions, it sounds like the agency has the capacity to take into account the practical necessities of the industry alongside the necessities to protect the public and to protect the basic function of government that's happening within the agency.
Yes. And we can see that agencies have to respond again and again to different items. So the very last one, we'll talk about shoes. So when did you have to start taking off your shoes?
I mean, I think it was like 2011.
2001.
2001? I don't remember it being that long.
I know. It seems crazy. So this is December. It's just a few months after September 11th.
I do remember his name, Richard Reed.
Excellent. Do you remember what he was doing?
He was like fiddling with the shoes on the aircraft, and the flight attendant noticed something odd hanging out of his shoes. And they immediately contacted the pilot, and it kind of like blew up into this whole thing, and he became known as the shoe bomber.
Yeah, good memory. He had a fuse coming out of his shoe that he was trying to light on board the plane. It wouldn't light. It seems likely that the sweat from his feet had made the explosives contaminated enough that it wouldn't blow up. But that was when everybody got really concerned about shoes. So if you're thinking, what's the difference between shoes and liquids? Shoes can be filled with plastic explosives, and those are a lot more concentrated. So we couldn't create this 3-1-1 system for shoes. The only way to check the shoes was to send them through the X-ray machine.
Okay, so I have a question for you. I haven't taken off my shoes in about probably 10 years because I have TSA PreCheck. Is that governed by regulation?
Yeah, so we've had to think about what actually makes sense. Obviously, people don't like taking off their shoes. It can be really hard if you're elderly and it's a problem to stand. It can seem really dumb if we know that somebody's safe. This is just one more thing we have to do if you're trying to travel with a two-year-old. So they created exceptions. And if you fall into certain groups, you don't have to take off your shoes.
Like if you get pre-clearance through TSA PreCheck, you're okay.
Right. And now that we have the technology where if you have the correct full body scanners, they can scan the shoes and actually check. This is something that shouldn't really have to happen for very much longer. But that's because the agency had the ability to adapt immediately when they recognized the threat and to make readjustments as the threat scenario changed.
So their expertise is combined with how they operationalize the law in the form of the regulation.
Yes.
Fantastic. I love that.
So next time we do the other half of the non-delegation doctrine. That's what controls whether we determine a delegation as proper, and that's whether Congress has given the agency an intelligible principle.